The campaign is seen from the outside, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton dominated Super Tuesday, but it's still early in primary season. We'll hear from a Republican in London.
I think the main question I've been getting is, why is it so complicated? Why can't you just vote and whoever wins, wins?
And we'll find out how a Democrat in Sweden will actually vote.
There's a cafe in Stockholm, actually, where there will be someone running a polling booth, just like in the U.S., and I will go in and cast my ballot like everybody else.
Plus, veteran British reporter Gary Young on the craziness of this election.
As a journalist, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. You're just walking over one story to get to another.
All that, plus the hip-hop artist from Ecuador's Amazon, ahead on The World. Big wins last night for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But on this Wednesday after Super Tuesday, it ain't over yet. The fight for both Republican and Democratic presidential nominations goes on, and the whole spectacle can seem excruciatingly long and maddening to us here in the U.S. But what does it look like from outside the country? We're going to kick things off today by checking in with two Americans living abroad. One is a Democrat, the other a Republican. The first is Stacey Hilliard. She's a registered Republican from Texas, currently living in London. She voted absentee yesterday for Marco Rubio.
I think it's always interesting when election season comes around and whenever anything major politically happens in the U.S. When you're overseas, you're able to actually take a little bit of a step back and observe your politics in a slightly different frame of reference, because you have a local context that you're able to compare it to and compare and contrast, and you're much more globally minded than you may have been before you left the U.S. So it's certainly been interesting at home and abroad to watch this primary season. And I find myself very often educating people just on the system and how complex it actually is, as opposed to actually sharing my personal viewpoint.
What are some of the things they ask you about?
I think the main question I've been getting is, why is it so complicated? Why can't you just vote and whoever wins, wins? And that's always a big question every 4 years, whether it's the Electoral College or now people are really starting to learn about delegates. And I tell you what, I have a lot of friends here who probably know more about the delegate selection system than people that are friends with and family back home in the U.S. They really get their teeth into it over here. They really enjoy observing and watching U.S. politics. That's always a big one. One right now, of course, with the Republican campaign is Trump. And that's kind of where they leave it with the question and let you answer. And just the dynamics of the party. How are they different? How does it work? Why are you allowing a Bush to run and a Clinton to run? How is that the only options? Those are the types of questions that you get a lot. But also you get a lot of commentary and not so many questions, particularly at dinner parties where you kind of get cornered as soon as they hear the American accent. And depending on your political persuasion and theirs, sometimes you don't get to talk too much.
At parties, have people kind of cornered you and asked you certain things about the Republican field when they find out you're a Republican?
They have. And I remember when I first moved over here in 2004, we were having people over for a party with all my flatmates when I first moved here, and I was a graduate student. And one of my friends came over, and he brought in his beers and was cornered right away. And somebody said, "Ah, you're American. I can't believe you voted in Bush again." And he said the guy went after him for about 20 minutes without even saying anything. He goes, "Hi, I'm Ted, and I'm going to go put my beers in the fridge, and I voted for Bush. It's been nice meeting you." And the guy just went, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And that does tend to happen quite a bit. People do just feel that because you're American, you become a representative of your country, and you become an expert on everything that is American, and really want to address all of their issues with you.
Ultimately, has living abroad changed your political views at all?
Maybe a little bit, but I don't necessarily think it has to a great deal. But I have known people who have moved maybe more to the center, but sometimes it has the opposite effect. And you do see people who become much more conservative. I know I've actually become much more patriotic living overseas. It is something you do represent your country, and it is something that if you were even a little bit patriotic before you left, you'll be much more so before you come back.
Stacey Hilliard is a Republican from Texas, currently living in London. Now let's hear from a Democrat who lives in Sweden. Ian Higham is from Pennsylvania. He's now a PhD candidate in political science at Stockholm University. I asked him what Swedes make of the U.S. presidential race.
They seem fairly baffled by it, I think, because they thought it was a joke for so long. But also, they sort of view America as being more conservative than Europe, but also being more of a melting pot, more open to integration. And so for that rhetoric to be sort of reproduced in the U.S. by Donald Trump is really shocking for them.
You're living in Sweden, which is, you know, one of those Scandinavian countries that separates its trash properly and spends a lot of money on international affairs and is doing all the right things. Is there a sort of a unified view of who should win in the U.S. election?
I don't think so. So first of all, Sweden is, its reputation is deserved. It is a welfare state, but there are some contradictions in there. They're a huge exporter of weapons. They're not so fond of the kind of surveillance of big governments that, you know, the NSA proliferated under the Democrats. And so I don't think that the views are as homogenous, but I think in general, they're almost all supporting the Democrats. And I would say there's a lean towards supporting Bernie Sanders. But I have to say that's not because they see him as the closest thing to a Swedish politician. It's the same trend, actually, that we're seeing in the U.S. They like that he's not part of the establishment. They like that Sweden can establish relations with a fresh president and not another Clinton or another Bush. It's not so much because of the welfare state tradition.
What do they think of someone like Donald Trump now that, as you say, Swedes realize he's a serious contender?
I think it scares them a bit. The rise to power of Donald Trump parallels the rise that they fear in Europe. They're afraid of Marine Le Pen winning in France. They're afraid of the Sweden Democrats.
The Sweden Democrats are the Swedish right-wing party?
Yeah, they're the far-right party. They have a sort of a history rooted in the neo-Nazi party, and they were treated as really a non-threat, as something that was totally irrelevant. But now they're polling at over 20% nationwide, and that's not small in a multi-party system. So, you know, to them, seeing Donald Trump was kind of a wake-up call that this kind of populist, anti-immigrant, especially anti-Muslim rhetoric is powerful and may actually sway a significant amount of the population.
Ian, you're from Pennsylvania. Will you be voting in the Pennsylvania primary in late April?
No, actually, I'll be voting in Sweden in person in the Democrats Abroad primary.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So Republicans overseas does not do the same thing, but Democrats Abroad is sort of treated as its own constituency for the purposes of the primary. And they actually have polling locations worldwide, or you can vote by email. There's a cafe in Stockholm, actually, where there will be someone running a polling booth, just like in the U.S., and I will go in and cast my ballot like everybody else.
Who are you going to vote for?
I think I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Do you run into other Americans there who have different political views, and do you guys kind of, you know, go ahead?
You know, I don't meet a lot of Americans in Sweden. I meet some. And I would say most are supporting Bernie, and I'm supporting Hillary, but we tend to respect each other. I mean, I respect Bernie. I like Bernie, and I think they feel the same way about Hillary. You don't really meet Republicans living in Scandinavia. It's pretty rare for them to want to live in a country with such high taxation and going against these core Republican policy preferences. But no, I don't think that I spar with the people that I do meet, because most of them are pretty centrist Democrat.
Do the results so far in these primaries worry you?
Well, on the Democratic side, actually, I'm not worried at all. I think it's really great that Bernie Sanders has been able to gather so much support for a less mainstream platform. And I think regardless of your views in the Democratic Party, whether you're more to the Hillary side or more to the Bernie side, I think these are issues that we need to debate. On the Republican side, I'm a bit worried. I worry about it as an American living overseas. I worry about the reputation of the United States abroad if Donald Trump comes to power.
Ian Higham is getting his PhD in political science at Stockholm University. He's a registered Democrat and is from Pennsylvania. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
We just heard from two Americans abroad. Later in the show, we'll get other foreign perspectives on the U.S. election, including British columnist Gary Young's take on the race. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on The World. There's a new front in the fight against the Zika virus, and it's on U.S. territory. Puerto Rico has declared a public health emergency as the mosquito-borne disease spreads through the island. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says there could be 700,000 Zika cases in Puerto Rico by the end of this year. That would mean about 1 in 5 people on the island would be infected. We're not there yet, but the CDC is worried. My BBC colleague Tulip Mazumdar visited both Puerto Rico and the CDC's Situation Room in Atlanta to assess the situation.
Well, at the moment, the situation is that there are just over 100 Zika cases in Puerto Rico. But given that most people don't actually show symptoms when they have Zika, authorities think there are probably many more than that. What they are saying at this point is that they are expecting, as you said, hundreds of thousands of people to catch Zika. The problem that certainly the CDC and Ministry of Health officials in Puerto Rico are focusing on is pregnant women because of this suspected, strongly suspected link to microcephaly, babies being born with underdeveloped brains.
You mentioned there's 100 cases, known cases of Zika in Puerto Rico. Do any of them involve pregnant women?
So we understand 5 pregnant women are infected with Zika. We won't know whether their babies have been adversely affected for at least a few months. In the meantime, we've spent some time with Puerto Rican health officials, for example, in the shopping center, San Juan's main shopping center. They were there giving out information to pregnant women, calling them in to tell them about Zika, tell them about the risks, tell them how to protect themselves. And they've been giving out information kits, which include mosquito repellent, bed nets, and also condoms because of this fear about sexually transmitted cases of the Zika virus.
What has made Puerto Rico so vulnerable to the virus?
Well, the island has had the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the Zika-transmitting mosquito, there for many centuries. A very high number, something like 90% of people on the island have been infected with dengue. A couple of years ago, chikungunya came along, a new virus transmitted by the same mosquito came along, and that infected about 1 in 4 people in the space of just a few months of it first arriving. So this is a country, an island, that is very susceptible to diseases spread by the Aedes aegypti mosquito.
Now, there hasn't been a direct link made between microcephaly and the Zika virus, but are there any cases of microcephaly known in Puerto Rico?
There are no known cases of microcephaly in Puerto Rico at the moment, and we won't know of any probably until at least a good few months. The virus has only been in Puerto Rico, as far as we know, since the start of the year, so anybody infected won't know until they start giving birth or, you know, in some cases they can have scans which can show them earlier. The link between microcephaly and Zika is strongly suspected. It hasn't been confirmed yet, and scientists in Atlanta, at the CDC and elsewhere are urgently trying to find out what this link means, whether it's a causative link, whether it's just an association. And once that is established, they will be able to make some more recommendations. In the meantime, they have to assume that there is a link because at the same time, we've seen a large number of Zika cases. We've also seen a large number of microcephaly cases.
Now, you've visited the CDC's Situation Room in Atlanta. What is their strategy for dealing with this problem? Do they have a long-term plan?
They are taking a many-pronged approach to this because there isn't just one answer to dealing with the Zika outbreak. The key strategy at the moment is protecting pregnant women. They are suggesting if people are pregnant or planning to get pregnant in the immediate future, not to travel or to reconsider traveling to Zika-hit countries. So that's a primary focus. They are also carrying out a huge amount of research on new diagnostic tests and vaccines. Another key issue is finding the right tools to kill these insects. So the insecticides that are used, there's a lot of research going on into what are the best insecticides. Many are not as effective as they used to be. The mosquitoes are showing resistance to them. So there is a lot of work to do, but really a key focus at the moment is protecting pregnant women.
Tulip Mazumdar reports on global health for the BBC. Thanks, Tulip.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what spending a year on the International Space Station will do to you. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Let's talk politics again, this time with British columnist Gary Young. He says a lot of people are tugging at his sleeve these days, asking for an explanation.
People would ask me, they're not serious, right? This isn't really going to happen.
They mean Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination. Young covers the U.S. political scene for Britain's The Guardian. He lived here for more than a decade. Young says when he returned to Europe last summer, he saw many politicians who reminded him of Donald Trump.
Marine Le Pen in France, who's doing very well, is one of the most popular politicians in France, who is a renowned bigot and nationalist, or even Silvio Berlusconi, a showman, orange, like Donald Trump, and his skin kind of overly tanned. There are equivalents, I think.
But in the case of Marine Le Pen, you mentioned her. I mean, she and her father before her were very specifically anti-immigrant consistently. That was basically the platform of their party. Isn't that slightly different from a Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think in each country it will look a bit different. Marine Le Pen just endorsed Donald Trump, not that he'll get many votes from France. But nonetheless, I think they all play to the same anxieties, which is a group of white working class and lower middle class people who feel left behind by the world. I mean, otherwise, I think it's too much of a coincidence to think that America would have this at the same time that you had Viktor Orban in Hungary, the rise of the right for the first time in a long time in Germany. I think there is a connection.
You've been out of the U.S. for just over half a year. Do you recognize the America you left behind last summer? I mean, in the interim, Donald Trump went from very much a fringe candidate to front runner, and Bernie Sanders, Democratic Socialist, he then became a real challenge to Hillary Clinton instead of just another fringe candidate.
I do recognize it, which is different from saying that I would have predicted either of those things. On the Republican side, I remember in 2008, I think her name was Gail Quinnell, who got the mic from John McCain and said, you know, I don't support Obama because he's an Arab. And then John McCain took the mic from her and said, no, ma'am, he's not. He's a decent American citizen with whom I have fundamental disagreements. And that was a kind of signature moment in the 2008 campaign. And I think that that's always been there, a tension within the Republican Party, that since the Nixon strategy, when Nixon told his chief of staff, the problem is really the blacks, we just have to find a way to say that without actually saying it. There's always been this tension within the Republican Party between the mob and the somewhat gilded elite. And what's happened here, if we go back to the Quinnell-McCain scenario, is that Quinnell has taken the mic back. The mob have taken the mic back. And they're saying, this is not your party anymore. You are delivering nothing for us. It's our turn.
So what happens now? I mean, if, as you say, the Republican Party in its current form, of course, it used to be the Party of Lincoln, is in some ways, through code or not through much code, kind of legitimizing bigotry, where do we go from here?
I feel this is a bit like an alcoholic touching bottom, that there is a very plausible conservative Republican Party out there that doesn't appeal to basically mid-20th century prejudices. They can do better than that. The notion of this big government project, we're going to build a wall, when the net traffic of Mexicans is actually leaving America, not coming into America. And I think in Trump, maybe they've touched bottom, and that there will be some kind of realignment within the Republican Party.
But some would say that the Trump side of the Republican Party is completely different from the Republican Party, that Donald Trump is the alternative. And many Republicans aren't going for the mainstream candidates, they're going for Donald Trump. So is that the new Republican Party?
Donald Trump has a broad appeal within the Republican Party, but a very narrow appeal outside of it. And even within the Republican Party, his unfavorables are very high. In Britain, you'd say he's like Marmite, which is a kind of Vegemite spread that people either love or they hate. And so if he is the new face of the Republican Party, then it won't be a party that is being elected to very much nationally.
I want to ask about the media's role in all this. Here's part of a quote from the CEO of CBS, Les Moonves. Who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. What is the media's role in Trump's rise?
We were transfixed like everybody else. Here was a leading candidate for president saying the most outlandish things. We gave him more oxygen than he deserved as a news story. There came a moment at which the media had to treat him seriously as a candidate, not just as an also-ran kind of joke, maybe someone who was trying to get another series on TV or whatever, which he's run like that in the past. So it wasn't crazy to think that that's what he was doing this time. There came a point at which the media should have started treating him seriously, and I think they arrived at that point later than they should have.
I guess my last question is a personal one. You spent a dozen years here, and at some point you thought the U.S. might be your permanent home. Then you had kids, and at a certain point you wrote this. Now it was personal. I had skin in the game, black skin in a game where the odds are stacked against it. Gary, does this election make you think you're glad your children are growing up somewhere else?
Not really. If I was trying to escape racial disadvantage, I wouldn't have left America to come to Britain, I don't think. While there are certainly some scary things in this election, there are also some hopeful things in the election. I'm in Britain now. We're looking down the barrel of a referendum about leaving the EU, in which some very scary nationalist, nativist kind of rhetoric is beginning to flourish about what's essential about being Britain and what put the great in Great Britain and a whole lot of stuff that makes me feel very uncomfortable. So I think I would be equally uncomfortable wherever I was in the Western world, and that I certainly share my American friends' horror at the rise of Donald Trump, me personally. But no, I don't look at that and think, thank God I left. Not least because, as a journalist, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. You're just walking over one story to get to another. It's almost criminal, the amount of copy that America has provided the world over the last 10 years.
Gary Young is a feature writer and columnist for The Guardian. He has a new book coming out in November about gun violence. It's called Another Day in the Death of America. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Just a quick note before we bring you the latest headlines. They're back. Astronaut Scott Kelly and Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko returned to Earth yesterday. The landing in Kazakhstan was bitterly cold, but both said it was great to feel the fresh air. They spent 340 days, nearly an entire year together, aboard the International Space Station.
I can't imagine not having fresh air, not seeing my friends and family for a year.
That's Libby Jackson. She's with the UK Space Agency and has been part of the research group studying the effects of a year in zero gravity.
As soon as you stop the loading on your muscles and your bones, they start to deteriorate and they start to weaken. So astronauts and cosmonauts in space exercise for 2 hours a day. And this is to keep the muscles and the bones as fit as they can be, but still they deteriorate.
Of course, I'm thinking a year in space with one person trapped in very close quarters. Eesh. How did Kelly and Kornienko stand it? But Libby Jackson says the two got along well.
The crew just live and work together, and they always say they don't see the boundaries, they don't see the borders, the political tensions that are, you know, absolutely there. You forget about those up in space because you have to depend on each other to make sure that you stay safe and get home in one piece.
Sounds like Washington and Moscow could learn a thing or two from Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko. Welcome home, gentlemen. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Aisha Tariq grew up in Pakistan, and she's turned her experiences as a teenage daughter into a new graphic novel.
And the mother is flabbergasted, and she's like, "Jeans! No, no, you're no longer a child. This is not appropriate for a girl your age."
The suppressed anger of the Pakistani obedient daughter, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills and for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We've been analyzing the results from Super Tuesday all through the show today, and one name keeps coming up. Donald Trump. Earlier, I spoke with a couple of American expat voters living in Europe, a Democrat and a Republican. They said they get a lot of questions over there about Trump. Many Europeans see a parallel between Trump's success and the rise of Europe's anti-immigrant far-right parties. That parallel is strengthened by the support Trump is getting because of his anti-immigrant views from white supremacists. That includes David Duke, but it goes beyond that. Saul Gonzalez with station KCRW in Los Angeles spoke to the leader of one group that supports Donald Trump.
When I meet Los Angeles attorney William Johnson in his downtown L.A. offices, he's unfailingly polite. With his gray hair, glasses, and comfortable sweater, he looks like the model of a kindly uncle. But the picture changes when you ask Johnson about his views on politics and race.
Yes, I am a white nationalist. I support the interests of the white Western European peoples.
Johnson is one of the best-known white supremacists in the country and the chairman of a political organization called the American Freedom Party. Its roots go back to Southern California's Nazi skinhead movement of the 1980s and advocates for the separation of the races and an end to all immigration, both illegal and legal.
We have in Europe and every traditionally white country a dramatic shift in that the founding population is being replaced by immigrants, refugees, other peoples, so that really the white race is in peril worldwide. And I want a separate white ethnostate, but I want to keep the rest of civilization alive.
Although the American Freedom Party is fielding its own candidate for the presidency, most of its members, including Johnson, are supporting Donald Trump's campaign.
Donald Trump is the closest candidate to our position that is mainstream.
What is it that Trump is saying that you like so very much?
It's primarily the race issue. He is saying we need to build a wall. We need to stop Muslims from coming in. He's saying things that are good from a perspective of trying to maintain the integrity of the founding stock of this nation.
To fight for Trump's election, but it should be emphasized without the support or blessing of Trump's campaign, Johnson and his allies have organized in a very politically conventional way.
Well, we have set up a separate white nationalist super PAC called the American National Super PAC.
Yes, a super PAC, with its money bankrolling robocalls like this one to voters in states holding primaries and caucuses.
The American National Super PAC makes this call to support Donald Trump. The white race is dying out in America and Europe because we are afraid to be called racist. Donald Trump is not a racist, but Donald Trump is not afraid. Don't vote for a Cuban, vote for Donald Trump.
Experts who study hate groups in the U.S. say the American Freedom Party's support for Trump is just one example of a wide and enthusiastic embrace of the controversial candidate by white nationalists.
There are people on the far racist right who describe Donald Trump as our glorious leader. They actually seem to think he's sort of Hitler without the mustache and slightly dressed up in American clothing.
Mark Potok is a senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate and white nationalist groups in the U.S., including the American Freedom Party. Potok says that although virtually invisible to the political mainstream, the party, which rejects the usual trappings of traditional racist groups, is well known on the ideological fringe, and its support of Trump carries weight.
Well, the American Freedom Party is arguably the most important white nationalist party in the United States. By white nationalist, I mean groups that don't dress up in Nazi uniforms, don't dress up in Klan hoods, wear the veneer of kind of intellectual sophistication, don't use a whole lot of ugly epithets and that kind of thing. That said, the American Freedom Party is plainly as extreme or arguably more extreme than the Klan.
William Johnson says support for Trump will likely grow among white nationalists as the campaign continues. But he says Trump is doing so well during the primary season, Johnson doesn't expect that his white nationalist political action committee will really need to spend much more to support him.
Donald Trump is such a formidable candidate now that it really might be superfluous to continue doing robocalls for his campaign.
But you'll still have his back through the course of the campaign.
Well, we'll be supporting him. We will still be supporting him as we can.
For The World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
One place you won't find many Trump supporters is Mexico. Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric has never gone down well south of the border, not to mention his repeated vows to have Mexico pay for a new wall. The barriers that already exist at the border are bad enough for most Mexicans. The World's Monica Campbell went to one of those barriers in Tijuana, just across from California, to talk to people there. And Monica, it's incredible how the border fence literally ends in the ocean. There's waves lapping up against it. What was it like?
I was at a place known as Friendship Park, and basically it's right there on the border of Tijuana and San Diego. And so you go there, and on one side, Mexicans, every day they go up and they talk to relatives and people who they know on the U.S. side of the border through this steel wall. And people actually put their pinky fingers through the mesh and kind of clinch them. that's like a way to sort of touch the people on the other side of the border, and they catch up and families catch up. And it's just, it's a really incredible scene. And the fence actually goes straight out into the surf. So it's right there. And then you have Border Patrol on one side. And then, of course, people, you know, on the Mexican side, just trying to connect with their families.
Now, I know you spoke to people there. What did they say about this campaign, what it means to them?
Well, people are following the campaign in the United States very closely. I mean, you cannot speak to anyone in Mexico who doesn't have somebody living in the United States, whether they're a child or a mom or a dad. So people are following this campaign really, really closely. I talked to one woman. Her name was Elsa Marcella Alfaro Moreno, and she's a young mom, and she had her little boy there. Her boy was actually born in the United States. They now live in Tijuana, and they can't go back because the mom doesn't have a visa. So I stood there talking to her right at the border fence, and this is what she said looking at this fence.
It hurts me to see the wall because that wall is keeping me away from my family. Like, all my family from my mom's side is over there.
She also talked about deportations and how that wall or fence, however you want to call it, really symbolizes the family split by deportations.
You know, like, all the deportations that have been going on, like, before you didn't see moms getting deported, now you see that more often. We're talking about it more. You know, people's not staying quiet anymore.
Monica, was she somebody who was deported herself?
She wasn't deported. She chose to come back to Mexico for personal reasons. But now that she's on the Mexico side, she can't get a visa. So basically, you know, she sort of had to wave goodbye to the U.S. side of her family for an indeterminate amount of time.
The people you talk to are Mexican, of course, so they can't vote in the U.S. election. But I understand some of them are trying to lend their support to candidates in their own way. How are they doing that?
Well, there's a lot of cross-border talk, and they follow what are the candidates' positions. There's a lot of support for Hillary Clinton. There's also support for Bernie Sanders. I talked to one person. His name is Roberto Vivar. He was deported from the United States, and he hopes to be able to go back to the U.S. one day. All his family's there. And he talked to me about being pro-Bernie Sanders.
It's quite a concern for us because this election can shape our future. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate that has mentioned and shown any kind of interest for family reunification. It's only right that we do our part to help in getting him elected.
He also said that he was frustrated with the Mexican government for not speaking out more when it comes to the U.S. elections, in particular against Donald Trump, who, of course, has said Mexico sends its criminals to the U.S. and must pay for a border wall.
I personally think that our government should be more involved in this election, especially in defending the rights of the Mexicans living in the United States. Instead of that, we see absolutely no defense. We see like if our fellow countrymen are left out there to fend for themselves.
So officially, Mexico and the president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has been relatively quiet. I mean, we're just hearing today that the government is now planning on some forums to highlight how the two countries work together. The U.S. is Mexico's biggest trade partner. So we're starting to hear a little bit of a break in that silence. Mexico has been caught off guard when it comes to Trump's success. It's traditionally been unheard of for a U.S. politician to speak so disparagingly about Mexico. But so far, it's been pretty quiet on the Mexican government side of things.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Monica spent a few days in Tijuana, right on the border with the U.S., talking to Mexicans about what they're thinking about the U.S. presidential election. Thanks, Monica.
Thanks, Carol.
This next conversation might make some parents squirm. It's with Aisha Tariq. She's the author of the graphic novel Sarah, The Suppressed Anger of the Pakistani Obedient Daughter. She spoke to me earlier from Karachi, Pakistan. And Aisha, the title of your book kind of says it all. What are Pakistani daughters angry about?
I'm not sure if I can speak for the whole of Pakistan.
Speak for yourself.
Okay. Well, this book touches upon different things, like, for instance, like hypocrisy in society, and then, you know, sexual abuse that, you know, nobody's comfortable to talk about. You know, like gender biases, again, that are so accepted that they've become habitual. And the thing is, again, in our society, we're really uncomfortable talking about, you know, sex and abuse and harassment. It just makes us extremely uncomfortable.
Describe a couple scenes in your graphic novel. Describe the kind of, humiliations that a Pakistani daughter has to endure.
I have the book in front of me, so I'll just read from that. Okay, so there's this one part where she talks to her dad about driving. And she says, Abu, I'm almost 18. Can I learn driving? And the dad says, driving? There's no need. You're not old enough anyway. Then there is on the next page where she's talking to her mom. And she's like, Ami, how do I look? I was thinking of wearing this to the Hina's party. And she's wearing a pair of pants. And the mother is flabbergasted. And she's like, jeans? No, no, you're no longer a child. This is not appropriate for a girl your age. So, you know, this is, again, one of the contradictions. But one of my favorite ones is where she talks to, like, her mother and says, Ami, I'm going to Hina's house. And the mother is thinking, and she's like, all alone with a strange boy? And she's like, you know, ruk jao, which means stop right there. And she's like, no, Sara, what if someone saw? What would people say? You cannot be alone with the ghair mard. Ghair mard is strange boy.
Was that something you experienced growing up?
Yes, I did.
Is Sara, in the title of the book, is she based on you?
Some of it, yes. But it was also a collection of experiences.
One interesting thing about the book is the main character, Sara, she gets angrier and angrier. And and you express that, now I'm really angry. No, this is really, I'm really furious. But in the end, she kind of gives in. She gives in to what her role is. Why is that?
I think, like, in our society, I'm not sure if it's true for other societies as well.
Hey, Sara, can you just start your answer again? There was just a little technical thing.
Okay, my name is Aisha.
I'm sorry. Okay, here we go.
I don't know if it's the same in other societies as well. But in our society, at least, like, I feel like there's a lot of stress on, like, keeping up with appearances and on people pleasing. It's a strange relationship that we have with people. Like, we need to please them as well, and that pacifies us as well. So, for instance, like, she was really upset because she heard her parents say something good about her, and then she, out of guilt, you know, like, oh, my parents were appreciative of me, I just didn't see it. Something like that, and then you guilt trip yourself into being quiet. That's something that I have seen.
I think what comes through is the day-to-day nature of, of, you know, the sort of oppressive role. Your brother, your parents constantly asking you to do things. Brother doesn't have to do much at all. Sara has to serve the meal, clean up, and where the kitchen is, you call it the dungeon. So it really comes through. I'm curious how your parents reacted to the graphic novel.
I was really scared to tell them. I don't know, like, I was really confused about how would I try to explain it to them that it's not just about them, you know? The entire book is the collection of experiences, and, you know, that is how the characters are designed as well. But surprisingly, they were really supportive. And so was my brother, and my brother was really offended. He was like, you know, is this what I do to you? And I'm like, no, this is, like, again, a collection of experiences, you know? And so, remember, like, the title is not Aisha.
The title's Sara, the suppressed anger of the Pakistani obedient daughter. How have Pakistanis responded to the book?
I'm not sure. The only thing I can judge from is, you know, like, our local bookstores seem to be running out a lot. So I think that's a good thing.
Aisha Tariq wrote and illustrated the graphic novel Sara, the suppressed anger of the Pakistani obedient daughter.
I'm really glad you found me.
Congratulations. I really like the book.
Thank you.
The hip-hop artist from the Amazon. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Want to hear some juicy scandals about China's leaders? Well, you can read about it at least. There's a great bookstore in Hong Kong that has all the best titles detailing the private lives and power struggles of China's Communist Party elite. China's leaders don't appear to be too happy about that, and five men connected to the store have gone missing over the last few months. And they remained missing until this week. Isaac Stonefish covers China for Foreign Policy magazine. Isaac, I'm hoping you can bring us up to date. Where did these five guys turn up?
You know, we wish we knew exactly where they were, but we've seen them on Sunday and Monday on television with confessions that looked coerced, talking about the wrongdoing they did and how they hurt China and basically why their actions were illegal and why, you know, to be pretty straightforward about it, why Beijing was right in taking them away.
And what relationship did they have to these books?
They were the booksellers. I think some of them had written them in the past, but they were more the publishers and the people selling the juicy and lurid political gossip of China's top leaders.
And what do we know about why they have ended up as so-called guests of the Chinese judicial system?
Guests. I like that. Usually in a case like this, Beijing is making an example of other people who might be doing the same thing. There's an expression to kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. Basically, these men are the chicken in this expression. And the idea is that by cracking down on them, that's going to send a message to other people who might want to write and publish salacious and in many cases probably untrue details about the private lives of Chinese leaders and well-connected Chinese people. What's more interesting about these men is that two of them had foreign passports. One is a Swedish citizen and one is a British citizen. And that's gotten a lot of people worried about the ever-increasing ambit of Chinese law, Chinese enforcement, that, you know, even if someone is no longer bound by Chinese laws, Beijing will still try to grab them for something like this.
And the other wrinkle in this is that technically under the one country, two systems, people assume that these booksellers would be able to do what they do in Hong Kong. And so the idea that they may have been abducted from Hong Kong, that is also a big alarm bell, isn't it?
It is. It very much is. That's a good point. I mean, I think Beijing likes to see them sort of the same way that we see drug smugglers in Mexico, and that they're bringing poisonous material into their country, and that even though it's a different system, they're still, you know, because they're harming China, they should still be stopped.
Has China said what it's going to do with these men?
Yeah, not that I've seen. I think the public pronouncements we've seen from the foreign ministry or other organs of the state and the party have been pretty bland. If I had to guess, they'll probably get more than a slap on the wrist, but less than life in prison. It could be a couple year sentences. And, you know, that will scare them, scare the rest of the industry, but not be something that gets into a major human rights case.
Isaac Stone Fish of Foreign Policy. Thanks, Isaac.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally today, a story about a homeschooled hip-hop artist who grew up in the jungles of the Ecuadorian Amazon. Yep, only on the world. Here's Beto Arcos.
When Mateo Kingman was 5 years old, his parents moved the family to a small town deep in the Amazon. They were former leftist guerrillas who went to work with the Shuar indigenous tribe to help create a protected zone, the Condor Mountain Range.
El trabajo que ellos han hecho en la Amazonía justo ha sido darles herramientas para que puedan defenderse.
He says his parents worked in the Amazon with the Shuar people so they could defend themselves against destruction and to help them fight what's happening there. Eres lluvia, eres como el agua, eres como el agua clara por la cordillera. Tú vas bajando, mi amor, tú me vas quitando el calor. Kingman was homeschooled and he grew up immersed in the Shuar culture.
Pero todo el tiempo estuvo conectada con mi vida cotidiana que era ir a levantarme.
He says his daily life was connected to this environment. Get up, go gather fruits with his brother. In the afternoon, go play in the river with friends, walking and hiking on the Amazon trails. And running too. Kingman became an accomplished athlete. He later joined Ecuador's national track and field team, competing in the Pan American Games and the 110-meter hurdles. His athletic training came in handy one day when he found himself in an isolated Shuar village in the middle of the jungle and had to make his way home alone on a trail he didn't know.
Me perdí, me pegué una perdida extrema el siguiente día.
He says he got really lost. He took some trails he should not have taken. For a moment, he thought, I'll never get out of here. I don't know how I'm going to get out. He was really scared. He recounts the experience in the song Sendero del Monte, or Jungle Trail. It's about how the trails can be beautiful, but at the same time, scary. Magical, yet unpredictable. La madera roja en el suelo,
me recuerda tu pelo. Me acuerdo que al nadar contigo me desencarcelo. La cascada se transforma en velo. Va a cubrir tu cuerpo de piedras, cubriéndolo de hiedras. Contigo no me arredra ni la oscuridad.
But running still meant more to him than his music. Then, 4 years ago, Kingman was competing in the track finals to represent Ecuador in the 2012 Olympics when he encountered a challenger he'd never seen before.
Tenía un físico increíble, era gigante. No podía creerlo, nunca lo había visto yo.
He says, this guy had an incredible body. He was a giant. He couldn't believe it. He'd never seen him before. Nobody had beat him in 4 years in Ecuador. Kingman ran the race, but he lost.
Me ganó y me había preparado años así para ese momento.
He beat me, he says. Entonces, claro, I had trained for many years for that moment, but he beat me. He says his music helped him deal with the disappointment. Music is one way to let go. It's the mechanism to release all the bad stuff that happens in your life.
Sigo pensando qué pasó corazón, y es que me gusta mi soñar, que como paro puedo volar.
Kingman was dealing with other changes. He and his family left the Amazon for the capital, Quito, and he was in culture shock. He says it took him a while to get used to the rhythm of the city, the people, and the climate. But again, music helped him find a way.
La música creo que puede llevarte por cualquier río, así.
He says, I think music can take you through any river, like a canoe. It doesn't matter which river, it just takes you along. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's back in the host chair tomorrow. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.